Welcome one and all. This podcast is sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I want to thank them for supporting us all this time. Genuinely amazing people with an amazing product. I have filtered and sparkling filtered water straight from my kitchen tap. It's amazing. Can you imagine in the 80s saying to people, when I turn my tap off, I'm going to get sparkling filtered water out of it. It's chilled as well. They think I was a lunatic. Now, I'm always messing with this podcast, but I've decided to do a bit of brand change. Look at me. I'm like some exec in the valleys, aren't I? What are we going to do with the brand? Let's change the logo to red. Yeah. People in Asia think it's lucky. Let's change it. Let's expand the market in Asia. Actually, I went to a meeting the other day about something. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I was sitting there listening to this like PR marketing guru type person. And he said, this is how we exploit the audience. I was like, what? I mean, that language should be left in the 80s, should it? Exploiting the audience. But it kind of sums up the world we live in at the moment, I suppose. People have thought, you know, you lot, you're listening to me now, and I'm thinking, how can I exploit you? How can I get that pound out of your pocket and into my pocket? It's the YouTube generation, isn't it? You know, I'm going to play a computer game if you pay me. You can watch me play a computer game. Or I'm going to do some makeup, but you've got to pay me. And then I'm going to do some makeup, and you can watch me do my makeup. I'm going to draw a bath. I'll put some bubbles in it and maybe a bath bomb, and you can pay me to watch it. That's, or the Kardashians, that's a new one, isn't it? Well, not new, but the reality TV thing. Well, that's a, I can never get my head around that. It's, I have a lot of money and you don't. Let me exploit you. You keep watching me spend a lot of money. I'm filthy rich. I've got a ridiculous amount of money and I'm going to spend it. And you can pay me more money to watch me spend my money. They haven't got a talent. That's it. I'm going to spend money and you're going to pay me to watch me spend money. How the hell has that become a thing? When I see my twins, watching reality, I'm always saying to them, why are you watching other people's lives rather than living your own? I just don't get it. And I'm always thinking, why don't people sort their lives out before they all have an opinion on other people's lives and trying to watch other people's lives? What about your own? You know, stop listening to this and get on with your life. Anyway, I suppose that's why I've always had a problem with awards. I always felt I was like broadcasting for the viewers or the listeners. I was kind of your servant. You weren't answerable to me, I was answerable to you. It seems to, the balance has seemed to change slightly. The pendulum swung the other way around. But, you know, I don't know. I suppose with awards, it's like, I want you to tell me how good I am. And not only that, I want you to tell me that I'm better than all my peers. But, for me, whenever I get like an email or a tweet saying, I love the podcast, or, you know, it's helped me through this year or something like that, just any old crap. I like walking the dog with it. It just means so much to me. It means $1 million because I literally can't be asked to do anything. So the idea that someone could be asked to tell me they enjoyed the podcast is the reason why I keep going, because let's face it, I'm not going to become a billionaire doing this. Though on saying that, I've moved the podcast from SoundCloud to Audioboom. They're American, so I'll probably be moving to LA soon, turning into Billy Biscuits, Billy Big Biscuits even, private jet, personal chef, vulgar wardrobe, all that sort of stuff. I also realized, and this is the bit I'm trying to get to you, is I've got like 3 or 4 different podcasts and they're all going out on the same feed. As I say, I'm not doing it for cash. I'm doing it because I like doing it. And I don't want to stop any of them. I just enjoy doing them. Like, I know some of you aren't interested in the football ones and some of you aren't interested in the sort of learning stuff. But I mean, do you know what? I just enjoy doing them all and I want to keep doing it. So what I've done is I'm going to call it now the Lovejoy Hour, because they're going to be around about an hour, just under, just shy or just over. My name is Tim Lovejoy, so it's called the Lovejoy Hour. And you know what you're getting? You're going to get an hour of me talking to someone about something. So, you know, it's quite interesting. I've also put my picture on the logo. I've been told that will make people know it's me and tune in more. TV's Tim Lovejoy. So there's the changes to the podcast. And I've been putting 2 out a week at the moment. I'm quite enjoying it, but I'll see how that goes. Might just cut back down to 1. might go to three. Who knows? There's no gatekeepers and do what I want. Right, on with today's podcast. 15 questions to Ramesh Ranganathan. If you don't know who he is, you can't have a TV because he's one of the most successful comedians in recent years. He's funny. He's a nice fella. I like him a lot. Let's meet him. Here's Ramesh. Hi, Ramesh. How are you doing? Thanks for joining me.
No worries. Thanks very much for having me. It's good to be here. I'm very honoured to be. We've been talking about this for a while, haven't we?
I was going to say that. It's like, I remember having a conversation with you in a field at a festival, saying to you, you know, can you do it? And you were like, yeah. This was a few years ago. And I was thinking about that earlier on today because I just can't imagine being at a festival anymore. I've the first lockdown we had, I was really low and depressed about it. I've now got so used to it that just before we went to Tier 4 in London, one of my mates said, do you fancy going out for a beer? And I went, no, I don't.
I'm fine
just sitting in now. It's fine.
Well, the truth is that you just get used to what you get used to, man. And like, you know, when lockdown first happened, it's like, oh my God, this. And also, let's be absolutely honest, there are a lot of people pretending that they went out a lot more than they actually did. Do you know what I mean? All these people going, oh, my social calendar is going to be decimated. It's like, all right. Right. Yeah, because you were always out, weren't you? But I do think, you know, at first you think, oh God. And then the other day I had exactly the kind of the same thought. I was thinking, oh, I wonder when this is going to come to an end, we're all going to be able to go out. And I didn't actually look to that with any real kind of excitement. I just thought, oh yeah, I suppose it would be good to be able to do that. But I think, you know, as it goes on longer and longer, you just get used to it. You just sort of think, okay, well, this is how I'm living my life now, you know?
I've got to say, though, I'm one of the lucky ones, and you probably are too, but in the fact that I've got a job and also I love doing my job. So the 3 hours I do on Sunday brunch, it's just such a break in the week. It's like, and I watch all that you were on it not so long ago, and I watch all the guests come in and they're just so happy to be out and doing something and actually doing their job. All the comics love it because they can actually be funny again live to an audience, you know, and it's just great to be doing that show.
Yeah, well, it was a weird euphoria coming to do Sunday brunch, because I think it's like the first I think it's the closest show that I'd done to what it was like when you do it normally. Do you know what I mean? In terms of, you know, you don't normally have a full audience Sunday brunch. You just got the crew there and you've got the other guests, and that's how it was when I came to do it, you know, recently. And so that felt really weird in a good way. You sort of think, okay, well, this is like the old days. It's like, you know, that's what it felt like. Whereas a lot of the other shows you did, obviously everybody's trying to manage and do it the best they can. But it does, you do go, okay, this is a weird version of the thing that I normally do. I mean, admittedly, you didn't have any gas when I came on. But that was a difference. But like, you're right. It was that kind of thing of going, holy shit, this is amazing. And like, you know, I know, and just chatting to Maya and Jamie Callum and Rick Astley, like, just chatting to them. Yeah. In a room felt amazing, man. It is so basically I'm saying the exact opposite of what I just said at the beginning of this, which is actually I really miss it.
What's funny about doing live TV is when things go wrong, like there's no gas, or I don't know, I get research notes wrong, or something happens where things don't work out, I fall over, which was a thing I did not so long ago, which made quite a lot of impact on social media. Yeah, people always come up at the end and they always sort of say, look, I'm so sorry about that, it's the mistake, and how do we change this? And I always think, no, that's the point in being live, and that's why people watch it. They watch it for Matt Bianco, You're a Bunch of Wankers, or whatever it was on Kids TV years ago. You know, it's like, it's when stuff happens which is not supposed to happen. That's what people love. That's why it's
been
point of life.
I do think it's similar to stand-up in that way, in terms of, you know, when you write a show and you go on tour with it, you have the show locked in to all intents and purposes, but then stuff just happens in the room, you know. Like, I remember like doing Southend once, and there was this fly that just wouldn't leave me alone, like, and it became obvious to the audience, and then that just became a part of the show, and it was like chaos. It was like, you know, trying to respond to it and then trying to carry on without it, and then it came back and all that. I mean, I'm making it sound a lot less funny than it was, but the truth of it is, it's like afterwards you do think to yourself, well, that is a show that will never happen again. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's the point of going to watch live performance, is like, I'm going to see something that will never be repeated. And I think, you know, if Sunday brunch is as slick as you like every single time, then what's the point in it being live? You might as well pre-record it and edit it and put it out, you know? So I do think that's part of the excitement of it.
Yeah, it's got me presenting, so it'll never be slick. Right, now let's do these questions. 15 questions. It's a crap mechanism, but it's a way of getting me to have a hold of conversation with you.
Sure.
So what one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Well, I think probably that the piece of advice that I was given by my dad, actually, that has stood me in good stead is that nothing is make or break. You know, there's no, this idea that there's a single opportunity that you've got to absolutely nail to make all of the pieces, all of the parts fall into alignment so you can live the life you're supposed to live. It's just bullshit. You know, it's that, you know, you may feel like that at the time. And I had things that where I felt like that at the time, like things I missed out on, or gigs that went, important gigs that went badly and all that. But the truth is, if you really want to do that thing, you will do that thing, what, to whatever level. There's no, you know, there's no thing of like, if only I'd done this, who knows what could have happened. And yeah, that, you know, obviously there's a certain sliding doors element, but if you want to do that thing, there is no single moment that makes that happen. It's a thing, it's key, it's consistency, you know, and that's kind of the thing that it, not only is it kind of liberating, it just makes you better at what you do. It's like, you know, I'll go and do a panel show or something, and you know, if you're really nervous about, you know, I remember the first time I did Mock the Week, I was absolutely shitting myself because I thought, if this goes wrong, then they'll never book me again, then nobody will trust me to do this, and then it's all over, blah, blah, blah. But the truth is, if that had have gone wrong, and I wanted to keep on going, I would have come back and done something else, or I would have made my way a different way, you know. So that's really helped me, that advice.
Do you know, that's such a great bit of advice, that, because I'm just thinking about the amount of times in my career that I've beat myself up because I refused to do something, turn something down, or something didn't go quite well, and I'd literally spend a month or so going, if only I'd done that, I'd now be Saturday Night Primetime TV. I'd have made it in America if only I'd done that. And it's like, it's absolute bullshit. But
yeah, yeah. And you've got no idea. There's so many other variables. You know, whatever, when you think about something you missed out, or if only you'd done that, you then construct how you think that set of events would have gone. This is what would have happened. If I'd have done that, this would have happened, and this would have happened, and this would have happened. It's just bullshit. Yeah, it's just complete bullshit.
All right. What's the best moment of your career?
It's a difficult one, this, but I would say probably the best moment I had was on the tour before last. I managed to sell out. I mean, I did a few nights there in the end, but it was the first, finding out I'd sold out for the first time, the Apollo in Hammersmith, was like an amazing moment for me, because obviously you've got Live at the Apollo, and I'd seen so much comedy at the Apollo. The idea that I would go and I played there as in charity gigs where much bigger people than me were on, and I'd sort of be on as an up and comer or whatever, and I'd get to play that room, and I always felt a special affinity to that venue. And so to be there in my own, you know, doing my own show and having that sold out, it felt absolutely amazing. It was unbelievable.
Do you think there's one bit which helped you? I was watching a program, Mickey Flanagan, the other day, and clearly the out thing just made him, didn't it, really? It was such a it was so brilliant. Do you think there was one bit you were doing which kind of made people go, or make you even think, I've really got something going here?
Well, the thing that people, I mean, I think it's, I don't think there was anything as kind of as iconic for me as out for was for Mickey. I mean, that is like, people that aren't into stand-up quote that, you know, it's an amazing thing. But I remember doing a bit about being absolutely in love with my first child, thinking I'd mastered parenting, and then the second one arriving, and I sort of said, you know, I love him but I don't like him, and sort of did this bit about my second kid. And that is the bit that whenever I'm at Chessington or anywhere like with my family, people come up to me and go, mate, I've never heard it expressed. Like, honestly, I thought I was the only one that thought, you know, like so many people say, quote that back to me, you know.
When I was doing the Teenage Cancer Trust gigs, that's the one, that was the routine I was going to say was the one that I thought. And I was doing the Teenage Cancer Trust gigs, and it's a weird gig that, because you all line up and then you're all against each other and you're all pretty high profile who come on it.
Yeah.
And whether you like it or not, you're in slight competition with each other. And I remember that night, I thought you did so well. I think you might have won the night. And that routine was the one, because it came from left field. You start talking about your kids and then bam, I think you called your kid a prick or something. And it was like, what? What the fuck? He called his son a prick. And it's like, and I was laughing so much, and the, you, you you really got the crowd on side, and then everything you said, they were just hanging off your words. It was great to watch.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I think that's probably the one that people come back to me on, you know. But with that comes enough, like it's a blessing and a curse. That I remember, like I did this bit about teaching my son to read, and him like not making enough of an attempt at the word. So I did this, bit about getting really aggravated about with him, because he would sort of go, "Jack went strawberry," you know, that was his best guess. And then I'd sort of like have a massive go at him. And that bit like really took off, like, you know, it got shared loads. And then you start thinking, your imposter syndrome kicks and goes, fuck, I'm never going to write a bit as funny as that again. Oh, what am I going to do now? Just like horrendous. Every time, next time I do a gig, somebody's going to shout, "Jack went strawberry," and they're all going to talk about how I used to be funny and this bit isn't as good. Oh God, so horrendous.
Yeah, I was interested. Yeah, because on that Mickey Flanagan thing I was watching, there was one of the talking heads said, bands can just keep doing their greatest hits. Whereas with comics, you've got to just keep writing and writing. I mean, Mickey's able to do out because people want it. But you know, you just got to keep writing and writing and writing. If you do old material, everyone goes, we've heard it, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think it was Louis C.K. There was this they had this comedians kind of discussion thing. We had Ricky Gervais, Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, Louis C.K. I don't know if you've seen it. I think it's up on YouTube somewhere. But Louis C.K. was saying, and I know, listen, I'm fully aware that he's since been cancelled and etc. But like, but Louis C.K. was saying that when he goes, if you do the same stuff again, they'll come and see you and they'll laugh at it, but they'll never come see you again after that. Do you know what I mean? Because they just think, what's the point? I've seen that person's act, right? So it's so funny. You do sometimes get jealous of musicians. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not dismissing what musicians do. They're supremely talented. But like, you know, when they do, like somebody goes, go on, do your old one. Like when you do stand up, it's just like if people have even heard a minute of something you've done before, even if you've done Live at the Apollo before you go on tour and you did that bit from the show on Live at the Apollo, people are like furious, man, like so angry. Just send it. I came to see Ramesh Ranganathan expecting a brand new show. Sadly, 10 minutes of it had already been broadcast.
I love the idea of people doing that with musicians. Paul McCartney starts playing Let It Be. Oh, fuck off, Paul. Play something new.
Oh, my God. Hey, Jude, again. Are you kidding me?
Beatles shit. Right. If I said that, right, what is the worst moment of your career?
Well, the worst moment actually was during that Apollo run. Just mentally, actually. It's not like a... It wasn't like a low point in actuality, but it was how something had affected me mentally. And it is to do with actually what we're just talking about people talking about you having done material before. Because I was doing my third night at Apollo, and I've been having a really nice run. And for some reason, I looked on Twitter in the interval, right? And somebody added me saying, at the Apollo watching Ramesh Ranga, seen a lot of this before, this is utter shit, what a waste of money, or something like that. I can't remember the exact words. And I spiraled. Like, I felt like, it's so vivid, the feeling to me, is that the room, like, started spinning. And I took that comment, because I think it's because I was in the middle of what I've just said to you, which was like my career high at that point. I was doing the Apollo and this person said they hated it. And I went out to do the second half and I had a fine gig, but all I could think about was there's one person in there that was absolutely hating everything else. I basically had an out of body experience. It was absolutely like it was horrible, man. Like it was the closest I felt to having kind of anxiety, like real proper anxiety attack on stage. Like I really couldn't handle it. And the reason I sort of say that was like the worst point is because I became worried that this was something I was going to have to deal with going forward. You know, I started to think, shit, if I start feeling like this, I love stand up. If I start feeling like this when I'm on stage, this is a massive problem. And then afterwards, the bar was open for guests and stuff. And I went backstage and met a few people, and I just couldn't talk to them. I couldn't tell anybody. I don't know why. I didn't feel comfortable enough to tell anybody. Oh, by the way, I know I had a good show, but somebody tweeted me something negative about me, and it really upset me. It sounds so wanky to say that. But honestly, man, it set me off on a downward mental spiral that lasted a while. I've got to be honest.
Do you know James Acaster was on this podcast recently, and he said that he'd gone off social media purely because of that. He didn't mind reading the good stuff, but he realized if he read the good stuff, he had to read the bad stuff. And he said the bad stuff just started taking him over a bit, so he just gave it up and got off social media.
Yeah, well, the truth is you dismiss the good stuff. You know, like, yeah. Is that if people say, oh, that was like one of the best shows I've ever seen, you just think, oh, well, you've not seen enough shows, because I don't even think that. You know, and then as soon as somebody says something negative, you just focus on it. You can't help hooking onto it. But the truth is, I mean, I've talked to James about that, and I've flirted with the idea of giving up social media, but the truth is I've ended up becoming immune to it. I mean, it doesn't affect me now in the same way that it used to, but...
You know what, you're really opening my mind today, Romesh. Thank you, because I've just realised something, that when I stopped doing Soccer AM, you know, I kind of felt $1 million, but it was around the time that Twitter started exploding, and then there was all these people who, as you know, with football, you get a lot of trolls in football.
A lot
of people were just slagging me off constantly. And then there was like people in these sort of, it was these bloggers and these sort of, they now have got podcasts and stuff, were writing lots of articles. I was reading all about how I personally ruined football. You know, it's like, it was me who did it. And then there was so many lies being told about me. And it really, I always say, I didn't go into the corner of the room and cry. I just wanted to rip these people's hearts out. I was so, it was the anger. And it made me move away. I love football. I always played it. I always watched it. And it made me move so far away from football for a while, where I just couldn't deal with it anymore. And I was like, sod it. I'm just walking away from it. And I've started doing a football podcast now. And my love for it is just, you know, it just invigorated me again. I was like, this is fantastic. But it's amazing what effect these people can have on you. We're only human, aren't we? And we just feel like we're being attacked.
Yeah, it's weird. I think it's the, you feel slightly, there's something about, well, actually, I think football and comedy have that in common, which is if people don't like something you've said, they really hate you. They want you and your family dead. Do you know what I mean? And like, so if somebody, there's something about watching somebody trying to be funny, and if you don't find that funny, it makes you so angry. It makes you so up, and you tweet that person and go, I cannot wait for you to disappear and blah, blah, blah. And the same thing with football, because I did like football's funniest moments, like this Talking Heads thing for Sky. And I said something about it being funny when Steven Gerrard said, we do not let this, you know, I talked about his slip.
Yeah.
And every time that show goes out, I get a death threat. You know, like it's like people just get so angry about that shit. But I think that the thing that annoys you is that you just think like you were just hosting Soccer AM. You were just trying to do your job, and you were doing it in the best way you could. And like, you know, if somebody thinks you're doing that badly, then fine, that's their opinion. You wouldn't want to be vanilla enough that you're not divisive in any way. I think that's, you know, part of, you know, you shouldn't strive to be all things to all people. But for somebody to get angry and annoyed and sort of claim that there's something vindictive about what you're doing, or, you know, as if you're doing this shit deliberately, you know, you've ruined this, you've gone out of your way to fuck this up. You're trying to do comedy and it's offensive to me because you're not funny. I can't, you know, it offends me that you're able to do all of that shit. You just sort of think, I don't deserve this level of vitriol. That's how you feel. But at the same time, the truth is that these people are not giving it that level of thought. Do you know what I mean? It's just literally, they're just fucking venting. Do you know what I mean? And you have to, it's like road rage.
With jokes which go wrong with comedians, I always think what we need to do is we need to say, do you try? You tell a joke, Romesh, and people go, he's overstepped the line here, you know, and the press write about it, and the social media goes on one. What you've got to do is you've got to go, has Romesh, is he a bad person? Or is it just one joke? Because you can't be judged on one bloody line. It's a joke, like one punchline. Although you do get judged on one punchline. It's crap. Right,
well, Romesh,
let's move on. Otherwise, we're never going to get through these questions. Sure. What does success mean to you?
The truth is, I when I started doing stand-up, I always thought that I would consider myself a success when I was able to pay the bills doing comedy, you know, and you sort of said it, you sort of hit on it at the beginning of the podcast, which is where you said we're very lucky and that we do something that we love. and I do something that I absolutely love. And I'm very lucky in the fact that I can't tell you the last time I dreaded going to work. I've dreaded getting up in the morning. I've dreaded being away from home, but actually dreading going to work just doesn't, you know, touch wood, hasn't happened for me. And so I'm very lucky in that regard. And I'm able to pay my bills for doing that. That to me is like a success. Everything else is a bonus after that. Do you know what I mean? I feel very, very lucky.
Great thoughts. What other jobs did you do? Well, we know you're a teacher. Did you do anything else, or were you just a teacher? Just. were you a teacher and then a comic?
No, yeah, well, before that, I was doing cost analysis for an airline caterer. So basically, it was like an accountancy job. What would happen is I'd turn up to the chefs for the company that they're working for. They would work out, you know, with your airline meals, they would go, yeah, we'll put this on economy, we'll put this on business, we'll put this on first, right? Then the airline would turn up and they'd go, we want this, we want a bit more lasagna here, and we want a couple more olives on that salad or whatever. And then I would work out what the cost was to do for their whole fleet. So you'd have to like work out the cost of the ingredients. You'd have to work out, the weird thing was, working out the cost of the ingredients feels fairly logical. Working out the cost of putting it onto the tray was another thing that I hadn't expected. So if somebody asked for an extra tomato, you have to work out the cost of all the tomatoes, but you also have to work out the cost of the person moving their hand from the tomato tray onto the thing, because you multiply that out over however many trays, it adds up to shitloads. So that was my job for a while. And I found it profoundly depressing. I've got to be honest, I've sort of told this story before, but I used to cry regularly at work, where not in front of anyone. I remember like once I was really, because it's like one of my first jobs. And I remember thinking, fuck, this is like, I remember not really enjoying the job. I found it quite stressful. And the girl I was seeing at the time said to me that it had changed how I was out of work, because I guess it was sort of hanging over me, this being my job. And one day I got up, I left my desk and I went to the toilet, and I had a cry for about, I didn't intend to, I just went to the toilet, and then I just started crying in the toilet. And then when I came back and sat at my desk, I felt massively better. And so then like every now and again, I would just pop up to the toilet for a little cry. I mean, after a while, I realized it's not a way to sort of live your life, really. You've got something else has to change. You can't survive by doing this. So I ended up leaving.
Well, next question, Ramesh. What is your outstanding fashion moment? Could be good or bad.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. So again, my outstanding fashion moment. Sorry. Yeah. I used to dress very, very hip hop. My wife would argue that I still do.
You got your hip hop podcast, right?
Yes, exactly. So I grew up, it was really embarrassing actually, because I'd grow up like watching these guys that were my heroes, and I would dress like them, and out of context, it looked crazy. You're sort of in Crawley. Wearing like this multicoloured jacket because you saw Flavor Flav wearing it. It looks absolutely bananas. But the one thing that I remember doing is what would happen is I was convinced I was the shit, right? Like, you know, I look different to everyone else. This is like a cool thing. But obviously, like, looking different isn't a cool thing to be when you're a teenager. You sort of got to find your group and then sort of look like them. And so I was like one of the only people that dressed how I dressed, because nobody else is really into hip hop. I remember once I arranged to meet a girl at a club, and at that time I was playing with flirting with the idea of wearing a bandana. And so I decided to just go for it. And so I turned up at this club with like baggy jeans on, which is like new, normal uniform, like a big sort of oversized shirt. And then I had this sort of bright red bandana, kind of gangster sort of West Coast boys in the hood style. I looked like a complete and utter, I looked like I was doing like a pirate panto or something. And this, I walked in and this girl sort of took one look at me and just sort of escaped. She sort of said hello to me and then just said, I'll be back in a bit. And I never saw her again after that.
I'm laughing at you, but I was there at the beginning of the rave scene, and right. And I used to wear, I remember I had these huge big hooped earrings, and I used to wear shorts because we'd go out and dance all night, right? And then I'd wear, I don't know, a t-shirt or something and a bandana. And I remember coming down once to about to go out, and my dad said, why are you dressed as a pirate? It sort of killed my trendy sort of look. I always see with hip hop clothes though, you've got to be careful, because you either look really fucking cool, or you could just look like a big toddler because everything's sort of slightly oversized and you've got your baseball cap on. If it's on, you know, and sometimes I remember looking at Brian Harvey and thinking, sometimes I think he looks kind of cool because he dressed in all the baggy clothes. And sometimes I think, maybe he looks like a toddler. I don't know.
Some blokes just have it, right? And so when they, whatever look they're wearing, they look like they absolutely own that look. And then there's other blokes, and I would put myself in that group, that just look like they're trying to achieve that look and they haven't quite, you know what I mean? Like, you know, when you, the difference between a bloke that's wearing the clothes but hasn't nailed it and the difference between the bloke that's actually made that his own is so vast. And you can't put your finger on what it is. A lot, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of it is just sort of being good looking and having a decent physique. But there is just something about, you know, when you see somebody, you go, I know what you're trying to do, but you're absolutely not doing it. I'm sorry.
Did you decide about wearing on the club? I always think comics, it's an interesting thing, like bands. At one stage, you've got to go, right, I'm on stage. I've got to think about how I'm coming across and what I'm going to wear. Did you go through that thought process? Did you try any other outfits out?
Yeah, I did. I there's a lot of different sort of theories on it because you listen to some of the old school comics and they always talk about how you should, you know, be absolutely done up, be in a suit. And you know, I'm with Off the Curb is my agents, and the joke that a lot of comics make about Off the Curb is that as soon as you sign with them, they put you in a suit. And you know, it's that, and I did mess around with, I did try wearing a suit for a couple of gigs, but I couldn't really pull it off. And then I tried dressing really casual. And now I sort of settled on just looking like I'm going for a night out, because I sort of think you've made a bit of an effort. And the audience have as well, because often you're playing to an audience that are coming out to the theatre, they're going to watch you, then they're going to go off and have a couple of drinks or whatever. So I sort of think matching, at least doing the very least of matching them is probably the way to go. Do you know what I mean? I think is probably a thing. Just wearing a suit, I couldn't really get away with it. I looked like I was sort of selling something. You know, some people look great in a suit, like Kevin Bridges. It's a mate of mine wears a suit on stage, and he looks, it looks like what he's supposed to do, but I just can't pull that look off, man. Kevin Bridges, funny guy. He's amazing, man. He's amazing.
That makes me laugh a lot. Right, what do you do to keep fit?
Well, I do a couple of things. I'm obsessed. Not obsessed is the wrong. I've managed to pick up the Peloton habit, and it's stuck.
Wow.
Which is. A very middle class pursuit, I have to be honest, just by dint of the fact of how expensive it is. But it's like this, it's a spin bike, but you have these online spin classes, and so they've got these American instructors and stuff like that who you can do these different classes with different music. You can do hip hop 30 minutes, you can do, I think I did, there was a Beatles one on the other day, you can do high intensity, you can do sort of casual, you can do choreography, and they've got all these different instructors, and that's all fun and it's good because you get to do a spin class without anybody seeing you. But the added element of it, which I think is making it, which makes it kind of addictive, is the gaming sort of side of it, which is it tracks all of your numbers and it keeps a diary of when you've done workouts and how, if you've done a certain number of days in a row, it tells you that you've done that, and you've got an app on your phone. And so you're constantly trying to beat yourself and you don't want to screw those numbers up. And actually, it's the gaming element of it. It clicks into something in your head, because I'm an inherently lazy person, like deeply, deeply lazy. And this thing has managed to stick, and that's the only reason I can figure it out, because I do hate it. It's not like I enjoy doing it any more than any other type of exercise, but it has stuck with me.
That's how Snapchat got successful, wasn't it? On streaks. So you
yeah.
I don't know how it works. I never got into it. I tried my heart. Well, I did Twitter and Instagram, and I didn't really do Facebook that much, but I do Twitter and Instagram. And then when Snapchat came along, I thought, nah, because I'm having enough of my life sucked away. And then I downloaded TikTok to see what it was about. I panicked 24 hours later and got rid of it because I'd spent so much time on it. TikTok's
Mate, it's
amazing.
Insane. It's insane.
So good, but I hate it because of that. So I got
well, the algorithm is dangerous because it gives you more of what you're looking at, right? So it's so funny whenever people, you know, occasionally you get somebody say to you, "Oh mate, bloody TikTok! It's just loads of like really young girls with their sort of like wearing hardly anything." And you go, "Well, you know that the reason that TikTok keeps getting out." It's because it's attuned to what you've been looking at, right? So it's not like that for everybody. That's specifically bespoke to you.
That politician got, there was a politician, he got done for that once. He moaned about the Tories because he said that on their video was an advert for hardcore porn or whatever. And it's an algorithm. Someone had to point out to him. Brilliant. Fantastic. Right. Tell our listeners something that has been life-changing for you. This could be like, I don't know, a teacher or meeting someone or
my life changing moment was winning the Leicester Mercury at a new act competition. And I know that sounds like a very weird thing to be life changing, but like that competition, I was I had basically that competition. How it works is promoters around the country get to nominate their person to put up for this competition, and then in February at the Leicester Comedy Festival, all those comics go and do 7 minutes, and then there's a panel of judges. And at that time that I was due to do that gig, I was broke, and I was getting really fed up with doing stand up. Like, you know, I was just sort of thinking, I felt like I'd hit a plateau, and I was starting to feel like it wasn't going to come off. Do you know what I mean? I just felt like this isn't going to work. And I remember really clearly phoning my wife, because I'd done a gig in maybe like, I think Glasgow the night before, and I phoned my wife from the train station. I said, "I'm going to Leicester to do this competition." And I said to her, "I don't know why the fuck I'm doing this anymore." Like, you know, I was really like down. And she said to me, "Look, just go and do the competition and we'll have a chat about it when you get home, all right? Don't, like, you know, just try and, you know, go and do this competition. Don't be like this, go in there, go and do your competition, come back and let's have a talk about it when you get back. You're probably just tired." But I felt like I was, you know, really done with it. I thought, I'm just going to see how I feel. Anyway, I went to Leicester, and I don't know if it's because I was absolved of any nerves or anxiety about trying to win this competition, but I did win the competition. Like, the stars aligned and I won the competition. And it just felt like the exact like validation I needed to go give this a go for a bit longer. You know, it felt like a message. I know it sounds mad, but at that moment where I was mentally with it and how I felt about it and how pissed off I was, that felt like exactly what I needed to go, okay, I'm going to keep doing this for a little bit longer. You know,
why did you start in the first place?
Well, I've always really loved stand-up. Like, I used to do stand-up when I was a kid, like just in the house and stuff. And I remember like one of my first gigs, I entered a talent competition at Pontins holiday camp when we were on holiday there as a family, and I did stand-up. And I've just always loved it, but I never thought I would do it for a job because it just felt so unlikely. And then I started doing it. I said to my wife, "I'm going to try and give stand-up a go. Not as a, this is going to be my job." I just said to her, "I'm just going to do it like as a hobby, like as a fun thing to do." And so I started doing it. And then I just started getting offered more and more gigs. And I still was thinking, I'm just doing this as a hobby. And then ended up entering a competition called Say You Think You're Funny. And they do these auditions across the country. And then if you get in, they put you through to a semi-final in Edinburgh. And then the winners, then you get through to this final. It's like a big prestigious competition. Anyway, when I did the semi-final, I got through to the final. And one of the judges said to me, when you walked on stage, as soon as you started talking, we knew this guy's going to be a stand-up comedian. And it was weird that, like, I thought, shit, maybe I could do this for a job. And so then, it was only then that I thought, I'm now going to start doing this with a view to doing it as a job. But up to that point, I just thought it'd be a cool hobby. You know, like how all teachers do something in the evening.
It's so such a hard thing to do, though. And I really hate it when people say he's not funny or she's not funny. Or the worst one is when comedians criticize each other, because it's such a hard job to get up on stage. And I know because I've done it, and I've not done stand-up, but I've gone on stage where people are going, oh, he's the guy of Soccer M, he'll be quite funny, and I'm not. It's like, I don't have any gags, and I don't have any routines. I'll tell you a funny one. I stopped doing it in the end, but I was kept on getting paid to stand on stage and give crap out and stuff, and I was doing it for a while, and one day I was in between Badil and Skinner, and both of them were at their peak, and they were just both really funny. And there was me in the middle. I could see all these people looking, going, he's a guy of telly. He's got a routine. And I just didn't have a routine at all. And then one day I watched Danny Dyer, and we were doing something, and Danny Dyer got up, and he went, Danny's brilliant, by the way. I love him. And he got up and went, you fucking slags. Like that. And everyone's like, yeah, Danny Dyer, he's doing Danny Dyer. So I ended up just constantly going up on stage and going, right, all Chelsea fans in the house. And that's the way to do it, because it's like, shit, I get a reaction. I can talk a bit about football. And I just thought, it's so hard to actually write some bloody material and be funny. So,
yeah.
You guys do it. Right. Do you have any daily routines? Maybe, or anything else?
Well, the one thing that I always do is, and I don't really have a lot of daily routines, but my one thing that I always have to do is like drink a lot of water. Well, not a lot of water, but I drink a fair bit of water as soon as I get up. So, and that's partly because I'm so bad at drinking during the day that, you know, and staying on top of that, I think to myself, I need to give myself some sort of head start here, because I know that I'm just not good at, if I get busy, I forget to eat, I forget to drink. And so, and you know, forgetting to eat is a minor, forgetting to drink is a bit of a bigger issue. So I try and drink a lot. Sorry, my son's just walked in the room here. I try and drink a lot first thing in the morning, so I'm on top of it before the day goes on. Because often my wife will say to me, what have you actually eaten or drunk today? And then it'll be nothing, because I've just got busy and stuff. So so I have to stay on top of it.
You're so busy, aren't you, at the moment?
I guess so. It doesn't really feel like... I mean... I am doing a few bits and pieces, but I don't feel like I'm at full tilt or anything. Like, I feel pretty relaxed about it all. But, you know, I do think that, like, for example, during this Christmas break that we've just had, I've had an idea for a new project or a new thing, and then now that's exciting me, and I'm thinking about working on it. So, yeah, I guess I do get busy because I really do enjoy what I do, but I don't ever feel like I'm not like... I follow a lot of these guys like 50 Cent and like Diddy and stuff on Instagram, and they're always about like, I'm that hustle, baby, on that grind, we gotta get it. I'm not like that at all. Do you know what I mean? I just sort of get into doing bits and signed up doing it.
What is the key to a good relationship? Could be partners or friends or family or anything.
Well, one of the things that I sort of that I've actually come to appreciate relatively recently is to really be in the moment with whoever it is you're talking to, and to really be fully engaged with whoever you're talking to, whatever time. And I think whether that's your partner, whether that's a colleague, whether that's doing this, you know, is that thing of actually not talking to people while you're thinking about something else, or not engaging with people while you're thinking about, I've got to go off and do this. And like, I found that that's made such a difference in terms of, you know, we've all had experiences, all parents have had experiences where you've been talking to your children and you've been thinking, I'm just listening to what he's got to say because he wants to tell me this thing, but I've really got to go to work, or I've really got to go and do this thing. it's such a horrible way to interact with people. And actually, if you actually stop and properly engage with your, with whoever you're talking to, but, you know, I think with kids in particular, you get much more out of that interaction. They feel like they've got much more out of it. And then you can go and do whatever shit thing that you've decided is important at that moment in time afterwards. Do you know what I mean? It's the same thing with your partner, same thing with work. I just find that if you totally throw yourself in that thing, it's like, for example, I'll give you an example. Like, coming on Sunday brunch, right? Now, you know, and I know that when you do Sunday brunch, you know, I've got a book out at the moment, so I want to talk about the book and all that shit. There's two ways of looking at, of coming on Sunday brunch. One way of looking at it is, I've got to come on here to promote this book and I hope this book does well and blah, blah, blah. Or you just go, I like Tim, I like Simon, I'm just going to come on that show and have a really good time, and everything else can take care of itself. It's so much better to do that. Do you know what I mean? And it's like to actually engage with the thing that you're doing. And I think that makes you have, that's to me personally, I found that helps you have better relationships. You're chatting to people, you're actually engaging with them, you're not seeing it as one thing you're doing before you go off to do another thing. I think it's made such a massive difference to me. So, I don't always do that. I'm a fucking hypocrite, man. Say this, and go and do exactly the opposite straight after this. But,
well, from the other side of that relationship, it's always brilliant when I get people like you on the show just want to come and join in and have fun and just know the show's great laugh. And I think the promo takes care of itself, doesn't it? People go, like him. What's he got? What's he doing? Talking about attention, people always say giving people time is a great gift. I think there's no point giving people time unless you're giving them the attention which goes with it. And I think giving people attention is a great gift. How is your mental health at the moment?
My mental health's pretty good at the moment. I've struggled with it. You know, it's something that I've had problems with in the past. And I struggle with like massive imposter syndrome, and like my inner voice is like really horrendous. And so I've had to have throughout my life, I think probably from the age of about 17, I've gone through periods of getting counselling and bits and pieces. As I've got older though, I've started to get better at recognising when I'm starting to go into a dark place. And like, you know, I know that people talking about lockdown, and I know I'm very lucky to be on lockdown with my family, but being isolated in the way that we all have been within our bubbles or whatever during lockdown is very, very tough on your mental health. And I think that the thing that has really helped me is to be aware of that and to recognize when you're starting to get into that place and come up with coping strategies for it. In the past, I would just sort of ride it out and go, okay, I'm about to have a month of like feeling like absolute shit about myself and let's just see what happens. Do you know what I mean? And it was never good. Whereas now I'm kind of on top of it. I I recognize, okay, shit, I'm starting to feel a bit down. What should I do about this? Get some exercise, talk to somebody, make a phone, you know, phone a mate or whatever, you know, whatever it is. I'm a lot better at that than I was, but I haven't cracked it by any stretch, but you know, I'm aware.
Let's move on to the next question, because I think it can be related in some ways. What's it like to be famous?
I don't know, man. I find it interesting because my wife is very, very, she's not anti being famous, but she's anti attention. And so she's quite a good barometer for how it's affected. Because like if we're out and about and I get recognized, if somebody asks for a photo, she will disappear, like vaporized. Like you can't, like she's absolutely nowhere to be seen. I don't not like it. I think it's nice when people come up to you and say they like what you do. What a privilege, do you know what I mean? To be in a job where people come up to you and say, I really enjoy how you do that thing that you do. That's a really nice thing. It's a really lovely thing to be in that position. I haven't experienced, to be honest with you, the invasion of privacy that other people have, that really famous people talk about. I touch wood, haven't had that. I have had weird shit. Like I have stumbled on weird shit. Like recently, I was doing an Instagram Q&A thing, and just every now and again, if I'm on the train or I'm on a long journey, I'll just say, "Ask me what you want." Somebody said to me, "Have you made enough money yet to move out of Crawley and live in Horsham, right, which is the next town along?" And I just said, for a joke, I just quoted and said, "Fuck Horsham," just a little funny like town rivalry thing, right? Anyway, that made the Crawley Observer, right? Fine, right? Like I said, comic Gromish Ranganathan and Stokes town rivalry, whatever. Fine, it's like not a big deal. But then like somebody I know said to me, "Oh mate, you've made the Crawley Observer," and they sent me the Facebook story, right? And underneath it, I looked on it, and I don't know if it's comments from people like going, "Oh, that was funny of him," and then there's other people going, "I hate him. I can't wait for it." And that's all normal. The one that really got me, somebody put underneath, "It's funny how he pretends that he's like a laugh and likes joking around. He's absolutely miserable on the school run." And I was like, she was like, it was a really vicious, like a really angry comment. And I thought, bloody hell, man, like this person has like properly formulated an opinion of me based on this kind of little tiny kind of cameo that I've had in there. And I do this. I've hardly ever done the school run. I must have done it like three times in the last 6 months or whatever. Right. Because I'm always away. So like it was such, that's the thing that I find weird is where if you engage with the idea that there are definitely people that hate me or think what I do is horrendous, if you engage with that, that's a bit frightening, I think. You know, you could be walking along just having a nice day and somebody walks past you and their internal opinion of you is that you're absolute scum and they can't wait for you to disappear. Do you know what I mean? That's a weird side of it. And I think as a somebody with any kind of profile, the less you engage with that, the better. I think if you're driven by wanting to do good work and you sort of think, I think this is good, let me do this. If you just are completely driven by that, I don't think you can go far wrong. If you ever start trying to second guess what people want from you, I think you're in a hiding to nothing, really. Mm.
Well, I'm excited about this next question. It's one of my favorite. I always like asking, have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
No, I have not.
Only Alex Horn so far has seen. He's seen a UFO. He's the only one. So I'm starting to believe they don't exist. I'm gutted by it. So
my wife and I recently had quite a heated discussion about it because she is convinced that ghosts do exist, and she phoned me the other day. I was on my way back from work, and she said, I've just heard this like weird noise coming in from inside our bedroom. And I walked in there and I felt a presence. And she goes, and I was worried. She goes, I think there might be like some sort of ghost in there. I said that I don't think it is. And she said, why not? I said, because they don't exist. I said, that thing that you're talking about doesn't exist. So I don't think it can be that. But she's like, I don't think she really thought there was a ghost in that instance, but like she's open to the idea, and she thinks I'm very naive to not be open to the idea. I mean, are you open to the idea?
Do you know what? Ghosts, not so much, but UFO. I've been reading a lot about different, what do you call it, where something exists in a different
dimension.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about that. And I was for my football podcast, because we do the A to Zidane of football.
You really did digress, didn't you, on this football podcast? Start talking about alternate dimensions.
We take a letter every week, and I went D, and I thought, which famous footballers begin with D? And I went with David Icke. So I started reading up about David Icke, because he's kind of Coventry, and he played for Hereford. And I start reading his stuff about different dimensions and reptiles and stuff like that. And it's so easy to get sucked into this stuff. And when I read about UFOs and how they're living amongst us, or they live in the sea, and it's so, when you realize with the internet, because I love reading about it, it's really easy to start, I'll use the word radicalized, but it's probably the wrong word, but it's really easy to start thinking, or everything you read, God, yeah, they've got evidence. And I think if I read enough, I could believe the earth's flat as well. So I find myself going down into the rabbit hole. And then I think, oh, what am I doing? And I have to pull myself out again, because I do love reading about it all, really.
It really does play to all of your sort of fantasies, that the idea that all of this exists. And so when you're reading, you're just like, holy shit, yes, yes, yes. Do you know what I mean? Like you can properly deep dive into it, man.
I seriously got so caught up with Noah, the time traveler. Right. So there's this bloke, and he arrives, he starts doing these videos, and he's called Noah, and he's got this, and everything, you're like, yeah, I believe it. And Barack Obama's daughter is now president where he is, and we're able to travel through time and all that crap. And then one day he comes out and says it was just all a hoax. I was just hoaxing everyone. I was like, no, I really wanted to believe it, even though I never did believe it. I really wanted to believe it.
So. Yeah.
All right, what's a couple of more questions. What's the happiest you've ever felt?
Probably the happiest I've ever felt was the first time that I went on holiday since I've been doing comedy with my wife and children. And we just went to Portugal. We go to Portugal a lot. And we walked in, and it was like a nice villa, and the kids like were buzzing, and we sort of sat down and started talking about what we were going to do. And it wasn't being in Portugal. It was the feeling of being with my family, and I'd got to a point where we could have this thing. This, like, we could have this holiday, you know, we could have this nice experience together, and we're about to have 2 weeks just hanging out. And it wasn't being on holiday. It was what that signified. It was just this thing of like, I turned to my wife and I said, we are so lucky, aren't we? And she said, you're having another one of your flights of fancy again. Can we talk about something else? No, she didn't. I just felt so lucky and so privileged to be doing a job that I loved, and I'd managed to go on holiday off the back of doing that job. It was what it symbolized. It felt amazing.
Did you know when you were on holiday that you had more work to come?
Yes.
Because that's always the thing with me is the problem with this job is I love it and we're very lucky because we love our job. But when your contract runs out, then you suddenly go, for me, obviously I need a channel to put me on. You can just go and hire gigs, but I need someone to put me on. When my contract, you always think I need another contract. If I don't get a contract, and so I go through this real anxiety state towards the end of a contract. Then when they produce another contract, I'm like, phew, sign it, and then I can feel happy again.
I know, but every year, I remember every year my first email to my agent would be, is it over? Because you're sort of like, I used to joke about it that on the 2nd or 3rd of January she'd always get that email from me, because like you get to the end of it and you think, shit, okay, am I done now? What happens? Because that's the thing, isn't it? You're right. We do love your job, but at the same time it's just much more fragile, you know. And you sort of like look ahead and you go, I'm happy up until I can see my last bit in the diary. And then after that, I don't know. Who knows? Do you know what I mean? Like, who knows what happens after that, man?
I get really, really weird and anxious when I see presenters and they ever appear and they used to be on TV all the time and they're not there anymore. And I think, well, that's going to be me one day. And I've always said this, that I turn up one of those. Have you ever done that charity day where you go to the city and you pretend?
Yeah, and you did
city,
the stock. Yeah,
it's good fun, isn't it? You always come away from there thinking, I should be a city broker. This just looks a laugh. But, you know, it was only one day. And I remember being there one day and there was a gladiator and the gladiators had finished, 10 years before or something. And he was stood there in full kit with his sort of like cotton bud thing in his hand, getting pictures take with people. And I was thinking, oh mate, give it up, fucking hell. Do you know what I mean? I got so anxious looking at him thinking, I really hope I'm not that guy who goes, I used to be on TV once, please give me a job, you know. So
but the thing is like, I know, but at the same time you sort of think he might be living a hell of a life doing something else, and then he'll just say to his other half, oh, do you know what, I've got to do this cotton bud thing again. It's for charity. I'll see in a bit. They want me to do the cotton bud thing.
All right. Is there something you've changed your mind about, Romesh?
Is there something I've changed my mind about? There's quite a few things I've changed my mind about.
The reason why this question comes about is doing this podcast, I found out about drug reform, and now I wouldn't say I'm obsessed with it, but I try my hardest to help them with the movement to try and reform the drug, try and make it so it's not illegal, and try and look at addicts as they need help, they're not criminals, and you know, and try and make it so that everyone who's not smoking weed is a criminal or doing recreational drugs, to try and sort of get some sort of standard to them, etc. Anyway, you know, I'll bore you with that, but I could go on all day about it. But it really changed my mind, because up until I did this podcast, I just assumed drugs were really bad and evil and everyone should be locked away. So real mind change on that. So is there anything you changed?
Well, I'd always been, and this sounds a little bit bad, but I'd always been a little bit, cynical and dubious about charity, to be honest with you, and sort of like, I'd always been somebody that thought, there's for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is, well, it's multiple reasons, but one of the reasons is that I felt like if you decide to generate a lot of money through charitable donations, what you're doing is you're propping up a system that should be sorting itself out. You know, you're donating money, and so that system begins to rely on charitable donations, but actually the funding should be there in the first place. For example, you know, like with the NHS or anything like that, you know, cancer research, anything like that. So that was something that I sort of made me feel cynical about charity. I also felt sort of slightly cynical about the consumer aspect of it, about the experience of donating to charity, about you see a thing and it's a horrible situation, and instead of engaging with the true horror of that situation, you click on a thing or you download an app and you donate this money, and then that's like you, what you're buying for that money is the freedom to not have to think about that anymore. You sort of go, I've donated that now, so it's like I built the well myself. I no longer have to feel bad about that, you know. So there's all these reasons that I felt cynical about charity. But since then, and I still donated to charity, and I still would, of course I would, you know, still, of course I was still donating to charity, but I didn't, I sort of was like, is this okay? And does the money always go to the right places? And are the motivations behind everybody involved in this truly altruistic? And I have changed my mind about that a little bit. I do agree with those arguments I've given to you, but I do also think that there is some real, really, really good stuff being done for charity. And I actually think my experiences, and this is only my personal experience, on a local level, I've been amazed and so impressed with what's being done for people by very, very small charities in local areas. I mean, you know, speaking specifically for Crawley, you know, the homeless shelter here, the food bank here is amazing. They've got a free shop here, so that, you know, like essentially a little supermarket where people who can't afford to buy food can go and have the, go and choose for themselves things. And there's all these little bits and pieces that are being done. And I've seen the very real differences they make to communities. I still think that we should be in a position where that shouldn't have to happen. And you need to look at the long-term solution of how do you stop that being a necessity. But you sort of have to accept the fact that, okay, this isn't perfect, that we're having to donate money and raise funds in order to make this happen. But this is what you've got to do now until we figure out what the longer term solution of sorting this out is. So my position on that has kind of changed a little bit, I think.
I was really hoping with a pandemic, we might have a little bit of a different way of looking at the world and economics. Call me an old hippie, but there's plenty of money in this country. Why is anyone...
We'd
do another hour if we did this, Romesh, but you know, it's like, how can we redistribute the wealth a bit better? I was talking to one of my friends the other day about tax, and he was going, oh, I want to get away and not pay any tax. And I said, you're not looking at it properly. You've got to think every time you pay your tax, don't think it's going on things you don't want to spend it on. Think it's going for life-saving operations for children. If you think that, you don't mind paying it, you know. Going for schools, it's going for NHS, it's going to save children, it's going to help old people. Think that's where your money's going. And I really do think the government on that, going away from charity here, need to do a bit better PR. Every year they should tell you how many old people were saved and kids were saved and operations, life-saving operations, and how many scores and how much they cost. And so when you pay your money, you go, yeah, I don't mind paying my tax money, because it's otherwise you can get people take you down a garden path if you go on the internet saying your tax is being spent poorly.
I totally agree, man. And like, you sort of think about whenever you watch Children in Need or Comic Relief, how do they encourage people to donate? They show you where your money's going. They show you what good your money's doing. So psychologically, logically, that is obviously the way to do it. Do you know what I mean? That is the way to, and this, you know, I find it incredible, this assumption that people don't want to pay. You know, people always go, how do I pay less tax, or I don't want to pay tax? But actually that your taxes go to provide great things. Do you know what I mean? It's such an attitudinal difference. I can't relate to that. You know, you sort of think your taxes go to do really great things and help people that are coming up through really difficult circumstances. It's something to be celebrated, you know?
Exactly right. Final question. What's the meaning of life?
Just a sort of steady kind of level of contentment, I think, you know. Try and manage the peaks and troughs and kind of level out. I think that's the meaning of life. I don't know.
Mate, thank you so much for joining me today. And what you've got coming up? What can we see you on? When's your next stand-up tour? What's happening?
Well, I am currently, my tour dates have been rescheduled for the middle of next year. I'm trying to do more travel shows. As I speak to you now, there is a production team shitting themselves about whether I can go away and do this thing in a few weeks' time. So I'll be on tour next year, and hopefully there'll be more misadventures coming to screens very soon.
I love the one you did in Scotland, the Hebrides.
Thanks.
It really made me think a lot about, I think anyone should, what's the name of the show again, Romesh?
Misadventures.
In the Hebrides. In the Hebrides, because just thinking about the way the people were treated there and the way the way it all gets described in the show and stuff, it just made me think so much. It really kind of moved me, that show. It's really strange. It made me think differently about the whole world because it's right on our doorstep.
Well, it was an interesting one, that, because, you know, first of all, the thing that hadn't been talked about much before was the clearances, where people were cleared off their land and just sent to move somewhere else. But also Sweeney, who was my guide, talking about the fact that he wasn't sure how he felt about tourists coming to the Hebrides, you know, because the physical infrastructure of the islands was so fragile and the culture was so fragile, that he was worried that if too many people came, they'd start adapting to try and accommodate that, and it would end up, you'd end up damp, you know, eroding his way of life. And it was so different to what anybody else had said. It was a really different, it was a really, it made me think as well, to be honest, because I'd assumed it'd be like, oh yeah, come and see the islands. It's good. And it just totally wasn't. It was a real eye opener, to be honest with you.
Such a great show, because it was done with comedy, entertainment, and lots of information. Made me really think. I wasn't expecting it to be like that, to be honest with you, because I sat down and watched it because you were coming on the show. And as I told you at the time, it really moved me. And I just thought it was such a great piece of TV. Thank you so much, Romesh. Been brilliant.
No worries, mate. Thank you so much. Take care. Cheers, Tim.